The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, alongside my co-host, Matt Miller.
Every business day, we bring you interviews from CEOs, market pros, and Bloomberg experts, along with essential market-moving news.
Find the Bloomberg Markets Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts and at Bloomberg.com/podcast.
Today's focus on fixed income is brought to you by PIMCO, a global leader in active fixed income. Learn how PIMCO creates opportunities for investors at PIMCO.com/bonds. All investments contain risk and may lose value. Consult your investment professional before investing. All right, so Lisa Bromwitz long ago told me I need to pay attention to these treasury auctions. And before, like, really, do I have to? Apparently, there was a two-year treasury auction yesterday that saw some weak demand. I think a five-year one is on deck here. So Ira Jersey, he's our chief U.S. interest rate strategist. He's going to tell us why we need to pay attention to treasury auctions.
You know, I had a producer, Tim Andriacci. He was always freaking out about the treasury auctions because our show was at 1 o'clock, and they always come out. I mean, what they rarely tell you anything, don't they, Ira?
So they tell you where demand is at that moment, right? And I think that the reason why the treasury auctions are so important right now is because they give you a hint as to who's willing to take risk and if investors are willing to take risk or not. And the last couple of months, you've seen a significant reduction in demand by particularly foreigners and domestic investment funds for treasuries at auction. And it just shows you that, like, you know, it proves a level. When you think about the fixed income market, it's not as homogenous as, say, the equity market is in general. So you have multiple bonds with different maturities, so you have a lot of different instruments at play. And by having a new issue, whether it's in the corporate world or in the or in the treasury market, you get to gauge real demand for that new supply. And you've seen that even though the sizes of the treasury auctions are getting smaller, you're seeing demand go down even faster. And that's the reason you've seen a lot of softness in some of these issues.
So why are the international buyers, why are they not there maybe like maybe how they used to be?
Well, but partially because I think there is a preference for cash right now, because if you're a foreign buyer where, you know, yields in the U.S. are, you know, multiples of what they are in your home jurisdiction, if you think that interest rates are going to keep going up, you don't want to be buying a bond because then you'll wind up losing money on the price side. So as 2-year treasury yields, if they go up from, you know, 4% to 5%, you're going to lose a couple of percent in terms of opportunity cost, and the price of that instrument will go down. So I think that's a couple of the big reasons is that you don't have the massive demand. You also have on the other side And this is part of the issue, I think, with the foreign investors in terms of central banks, is that central banks want to prop up their own currencies, because their own currencies are slipping very quickly against the dollar. And if they go out and they go buy two-year treasuries, they also have to buy dollars on top of that, which will just weaken their currency even further. So so foreign exchange managers aren't going to be involved in these auctions like they sometimes are.
I'm just surprised the Japanese, I mean, if you're looking at a situation where there's no reason for the yen to go down, well, let's say this. If you're looking at a situation where the finance ministry is defending the yen and, your interest rates on the 10-year are 0.2% versus, 4% in the U.S., wouldn't you want that?
Well, no, because again, you have to buy dollars then, and you're just weakening the yen versus versus the dollar. And if you're trying to defend your currency and trying to stop your currency from falling further, you want to actually be selling dollar-denominated assets and buying yen-denominated assets. And that's a reason why you have those foreign reserves. That is one of the dynamics that you're seeing in some of these auctions. Now, unfortunately, we don't know exactly what happened yesterday, because this data comes out after the auction settle and we get all of the other data. But the allotment data, when you look at it from the August auctions, certainly showed that there was a slowdown in demand from foreign investors in a lot of the different issues across the curve. And I think that is in part because of this idea that they don't want to strengthen their own currency. Now of course, if they have a maturing bond, they might participate in the auction just to roll over that bond. They're not buying new dollars, they're just rolling over the old dollars. No new money is going to come in. Even though interest rate dynamics are going to matter here, because eventually this might turn very significantly, because once the Fed's done hiking, I think what's going to happen is that other central banks are going to be catching up. And that's when you're going to see a significant turn in the dollar. And once you see that turn in the dollar, all of those flows could wind up changing very quickly. Now, I don't think that's going to happen until 2023, but it is something to look out for, because the Fed is ahead of the curve here. Well, I can't say it's ahead of the curve.
The Fed is ahead of
other central banks in its hiking cycle, right? So therefore, it probably will stop before the other central banks are done.
The Fed is the curve now.
The Fed is the curve. Ira, just a quick 30 seconds, a kind of a plumbing issue. Do the dealers buy, does the JP Morgans of the world and the Goldman Sachs, do they buy for their own account at auctions?
They have to.
Yeah, they have to bid for a pro rata amount. So okay. If there's 20 primary dealers, they each have to bid for 5% of the auction. So that's one reason why in the U.S. you won't ever have a failed auction, where you have less bids than you have issued. So they do buy for their own account, but they've been getting much, much smaller over the last couple of years in favor of money managers who are much more active and really the incremental price setters at a lot of these auctions.
See? So I just, I don't know. Step up and buy them. See, these auctions, they're important. I just learned something there.
Yeah, well, I mean, how important is an auction where you have a whole bunch of giant banks that are required to bid?
Yeah, but you want them to bid aggressively, so you got to put some competition out there. All right, Ira Jersey covers interest rates. He's a strategist, Bloomberg Intelligence. Also, we didn't get to talk to him about soccer, but he follows soccer religiously. He's also a part owner in some... I think a minor league, I think is a way to term it, professional soccer team in central New Jersey. So go figure. How many strategists that owns a soccer team? I mean, he's just like these big players. Next is going to be the Premier League.
Some Americans have to care.
Yep.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Matt, there are a lot of electric vehicle companies out there. It just seems like...
I saw a Lucid Air the other day.
How was it?
I told my wife, I said, there's a Lucid. She said, what are you talking about? I said, Lucid Air. She said, I still don't know what you're talking about. It was pretty cool.
All right, Peter Wang, he's the CEO of Centro. What I love about, there's a lot of things I like about this company. One of them is based in Freehold, New Jersey. You know who came from Freehold, New Jersey?
Grover Cleveland.
Oh, jeez. No. Peter, can you help him out? Who else is came from Freehold, New Jersey?
Yeah, we're in between New York and Pennsylvania and the Philadelphia.
Good stuff. All right, Peter, talk to us about Centro. What do you guys do there? Talk to us about your business, your company.
Centro's vision actually began in 2013. And with a desire to transform the commercial fleet industry to zero emission vehicles. Yeah, that has and remains our sole and singular focus. Yeah, we grew from one low speed vehicle in 2017 and to a full product line that currently we include 8 commercial vehicles and 7 for street use with multiple variations and 1 for off-road use. Yeah, so our mission is really try to lead the transformation in this automotive industry and try to become a leader in the electrical commercial vehicle sector. That's a little bit.
So who's your customer? Who's a typical customer for one of your vehicles?
Yes, it's mostly the free operators and also the municipals. They provide the local service, and which is basically for the commercial users. Morally, right now, it's 80% of our customers for city delivery and urban services.
So how much traction are you getting? I mean, what's your revenue growth look like and how are your projections?
Yeah, we are already finished the phase for the vehicle development. And we are looking for the fast growing in the revenue and in the delivery. And we are building our distribution and the aftermarket support network in America and Europe and some in Asia.
So you've already got 4,000 or 5,000 vehicles out?
Yes, so far, we already have more than 5,000 already being out to the market.
So who do you compete against in that part of the market? We're all, obviously familiar with the consumer automobile segment, the Teslas and now all the other OEMs getting in there, but who do you typically compete against? Who do you think you will compete against in this segment?
Yes, I think the company like a Workhorse, that's our primary competitor, and also the Rivian, and because Rivian they produce the pickups, they also makes deliver van. So that's the biggest main competitor in the market now. And I think with all the product and ready, I think we are kind of like a leading that sector at this moment.
So let me just finally ask you about the supply chain and the chip management that you've been able to do. What does your supply chain look like and how is your access to microchips?
Yeah, that was our, last year's struggling. So I, just like everybody's struggling for the supply chain, and where I think we are in the very good position right now, because some of our OEM is a tier one manufacturer and from China. And the previous we have a little bit of shipping problem. But now we see all the shipping price going down and we are now able to get the container. I think, we are strongly positioned and very well developed our supply chain base. I think we, in the supply chain we're doing very good.
All right, Peter, good stuff. Interesting story here. Peter Wang, he's the CEO of Centro, making electric vehicles for the commercial vehicle segment. So interesting, segment there that likely will be addressed there with a lot of competitors. So good stuff there.
What I'm very much focused on is in this space, but more of a consumer vehicle segment, Harley Davidson today is down on the New York Stock Exchange Today's the day that they merge their LiveWire electric motorcycle unit with the SPAC. The SPAC name is AEA Bridges Impact Corp. Hopefully, dear goodness,
yeah,
they changed that name. So it's going to be, I guess, called LiveWire now.
So you can get an electric Harley Davidson?
Yes.
Pound sterling. Steady here today, 1.077, but it has been under siege with mounting bets that it may drop below $1, the old parity thing. Let's bring in Stephen Gallo. He's head of European FX strategy for BMO Capital Markets. Stephen, is parity for sterling, is that a reasonable possibility?
I think anything's a reasonable possibility, or more so in this FX environment with this type of volatility and these types of swings. We'd like to say the bottom for the cycle is in. We're kind of hoping that the bottom for the cycle is in. The same goes for the top in the U.S. dollar. But I'd say we have moderate conviction on that view at this stage. In terms of the dollar side of the equation, we're pretty confident at this stage that most of what the Fed is signaling is now priced in. So the transmission of Fed policy to the FX market via interest rate differentials, we think that has largely run its course. But what we're more concerned about and less certain is finished is the extent to which the FX market prices in a higher global recession probability, as well as the lingering effect, or the ongoing effect, I should say, of quantitative tightening from the Fed. These concern us a lot for non-dollar currencies.
If you think most of the Fed rate hikes are priced in, where do you see the terminal rate?
Well, the BMO house view is, around 4.6. ish, give or take, for the effective Fed funds rate.
Oh, and that's what he said, basically, at the press conference.
Roughly in line with that, for the effective Fed funds rate, we've got them going twice more in 2022, and then hiking once again at the first meeting of 2023. But the main point here is that is largely already reflected and then some, just by a little bit, into the dollar OIS curve. So, I mean, if we start to see, core inflation showing clear signs of decelerating in the United States and we get 1 or 2 months of negative job prints, that will definitely be a big helping hand for this dollar peak story. But on the other side of that, we have to get through this issue of how bad the global and or U.S. recession is going to be. And we probably haven't gotten to the peak pricing for global recession risk just yet. And until that happens, it's going to be harder for the dollar to fall sharply. Until we're confirmed that it is, until the Fed does a major pivot, it's going to be hard for the dollar to fall sharply.
Well, this is a question that Paul's been asking for a couple of weeks now, and we haven't really heard anyone say yes. Is there any bear case for the U.S. dollar?
Is there a bear case for the U.S. dollar?
Yeah, is there any bear case at all?
In the medium to long term, potentially. In the short run, it's tough to see it. It's tough to see the dollar falling sustainably. If the Fed were to engineer some type of a pivot and were to confirm that it's not, and we're starting to see clear signs that core inflation pressures are rolling over and going in the Fed's preferred direction in the United States, the labor market is slowing, you still have all of these structural issues ongoing, geopolitical and structural issues on the capital flow side for a number of major European currencies, for Asia, ex-Japan currencies, for the Japanese yen. That the Fed pivoting to a neutral policy stance is not simply going to make go away. It might help the healing process begin for those structural flaws in those currencies, but it's not going to make them go away. When we're moving from an environment or an era of globalization on, where we got very used to ultra-low interest rates, quantitative easing, high asset valuations, to an unwinding of that, it's very hard for non-dollar currencies to rally sustainably. So that's the picture, unfortunately.
Stephen, you've been in this FX game a long time. What did you make in the actual trading of pound sterling over the past couple of days? Pretty wild moves there.
Well, I'm a strategist, so I don't have a direct.
But I mean, it's just the movements. What was that market telling you? Just the market was just really confused.
Give us an adjective.
I think that we've seen a very severe, but probably in my view, long overdue repricing of UK risk premia because of the fiscal picture, because of the debt picture, because of the balance of payments picture. And I think that caught up with the currency and the gilt market this week and last week. And what you saw basically was a liquidity event, a lack of liquidity in both the FX market and the gilt market, which made the price action 10 times worse than it would have been with that liquidity there.
Right.
We're getting into a situation now where risk premia are adjusting, but they're not adjusting in an orderly fashion.
Right. All right, good stuff. Appreciate it, as always, Stephen Gallo, BMO Capital Markets. Talking
we didn't even get
FX.
To the end. We didn't even get to the end, but that was, it seems like ancient history, but that was just last week.
I know.
That the finance ministry intervened in the Japanese yen
right.
to defend the currency for the first time since 1998. That was 24 years ago.
Yeah, 98. Remember it well. Good year.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Look at the housing market. We had new home sales data came out today. Came in better than expected, 685,000 versus a consensus of 500,000. A little bit higher than last month, which was revised higher. But certainly their housing sales are coming down from the peak of the pandemic. The question is, can this housing market engineer a soft landing, or will it be ugly?
Can it survive rates at
can
this
it survive
level?
Rates? Yeah. And what did you say the mortgage rates today?
6.7%.
Yeah. That's a long way from, 3.25% from just, a year ago. Sam Dunlap, CIO at Angel Oak Capital, joins us. Sam, I'd love to get your thoughts on kind of the residential real estate market here. How do you characterize the last few years and then maybe where we are right now?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Great question. To your point on, can housing achieve a soft landing, and given the pace of appreciation we saw and home prices really post-pandemic, it's clearly very difficult to sustain those type of levels. And as you all know, Case-Shiller came out this morning and it was below expectations and one of the more swift declines we've seen in the index, rising 16% on a year-over-year basis. But we expect, the pace of the home price appreciation clearly cannot sustain the current levels. But the housing market was really benefiting from, this historic supply and demand mismatch that market participants have been identifying for years. But the extraordinarily low mortgage rates fueled surging home prices, particularly during COVID. While that's not sustainable, we do expect the very favorable supply and demand dynamic in U.S. housing supporting home prices, but the pace of appreciation clearly cannot keep up.
What does it look like in terms of U.S. housing that makes you feel like it's supportive in terms of the supply and demand, right? Is there just not enough land? Are builders still having trouble getting construction materials? Is labor the problem? What's the issue on the supply side?
Yeah, on the supply side is, you know, we just historically underbuilt really after the global financial crisis, and that really has not changed. And very similar to the dynamics that we saw in the late 1970s with the baby boomers, you know, they were forming households at a very brisk pace. We're still seeing that from the millennials, you know, on annualized pace of approximately 1.2 million household formations today. And that's very supportive as, you know, the demand for single family shelter, particularly coming out of COVID, still remains strong. But affordability has really been the challenge here as the Fed is inflicted, as Chairman Powell wanted, a lot of pain clearly on the economy. And the initial transmission mechanism has definitely been surging mortgage rates, as you pointed out. And that's really hurt the affordability aspect, but the underlying demand and lack of supply and just the fact of how underbuilt U.S. housing is, we think, you know, achieves that soft landing for U.S. housing and not the, you know, extreme downturn that we saw really coming out of the financial crisis.
What are you doing in your fund, Sam? You manage the Angel Oak Multi-Strategy Income Fund, the Strategic Credit Fund, the Core Impact Fund, the Multi-Strategy Income UCITS Fund. I don't even know what UCITS means, but what are you doing in those funds right now?
Yeah, so, you know, the mortgage market, like all areas of fixed income, has been under a tremendous amount of pressure this year, just given the swift pace of tightening and a complete revision of Fed expectations. But mortgages have been particularly sensitive to what we're describing as really a volatility shock. So, you know, we went through the first phase of the inflation shock as inflation went parabolic this year, as we all know very well at this point. But also you saw rates clearly reprice very swiftly and volatility surging and the interest rate world to historic highs. And from a volatility perspective, we're really at crisis-like levels from an historical standpoint. And that presents an extraordinarily favorable time for mortgages in particular, as we view, you know, this near-term event as not necessarily a credit event where, you know, mortgage credit is frankly pristine and it's the best that we've ever seen it. The underwriting standards have been extraordinary. Unemployment remains very, very low, and we still have a very brisk labor market. But mortgages, given the volatility and rate shock that we've seen, have really widened out from a spread perspective. Both agency and non-agency mortgages present, in our view, an extraordinarily favorable opportunity here to lock in, you know, equity-like returns in very high-quality areas of fixed income. And we think that, you know, patient investors will be rewarded, you know, in this amidst this volatility shock we're currently in.
Sam, just about 30 seconds, but where does demand destruction come in from a mortgage rate perspective here?
Well, I think you're starting to see that demand destruction pretty significantly, just given the deterioration that we've seen in affordability. But as mortgage investors, you know, it's not necessarily contingent on the pace of housing activity. We definitely expected a slowdown in housing activity. But what's important, clearly, is more of the delinquencies and what that actual home price is if you actually have a default, particularly in non-agency mortgages, and what that ultimate recovery value is. And so, you know, if you think about the LTV of the U.S. housing market today at approximately 30%, we've never seen this much equity in the housing right. market. So we think, you know, the resiliency of the underlying asset class will hold up quite well. Yep. But there is a tremendous amount of demand destruction just given the surge that we've seen in mortgage rates. Yep. And again, activity will continue to slow.
All right, Sam, good stuff. Really appreciate getting the review update on the mortgage market, housing market. Sam Dunlap, CIO at Angel Oak Capital, talking about the housing market here. Such a surge in the early part of the pandemic, coming back down to reality. Hurricane Ian, it made landfall in Cuba. Now it's got its sights on Florida. It looks like the west coast of Florida is going to get the brunt of it. Of course, that brings into question Tampa. And when you think about big, big metro cities, you think about, you know, some of the insured losses there and what that means for some of the big insurance companies, in addition to the good folks on the ground. Matthew Palazzola, Bloomberg Intelligence senior analyst covering property and casualty insurance. He joins us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. Tampa's a big market, big insured market. What are some of the estimates here of potential damage?
And apparently it's not a place that gets hit by hurricanes a lot.
does not get hit by hurricanes often. There were some analogs in the 1800s, the 40s, the 50s, but nothing directly hitting Tampa. Lloyd's of London has a scenario, not for this storm specifically, but for a direct hit on Tampa, which could be $100 billion of damage.
Now, that's big, right?
That is big. That would be the biggest insured loss ever. I don't know if it would. This storm is probably not getting to that level, but if we're talking about insured value in the region, that's what we're looking at.
It's going to miss the oil rigs, right? So it's not going to go, Brian Sullivan was telling us yesterday, it's probably not going to be west enough to hit the oil production hubs.
That is correct. So it's really focusing more east. So the models come out every 6 hours, and they've been shifting. Initially, they were all the way from Louisiana to Florida, but they've been moving more and more east to the Florida.
So how far is it right now from the Florida coast?
So it's about 48 hours from landfall in Florida, and we still don't know. The latest run, literally just came out minutes before I came in here, was a little more south of Tampa, so a little bit better of a forecast from an insured loss point of view, a category 1 to 2 versus a 2 to 3, and south of Tampa.
Okay, so what are some of the companies that maybe have exposure there from an insurance perspective or reinsurers?
So it's interesting, what's going on is the reinsurance companies will definitely have exposure. Those are names like...
So a reinsurer insures the insurance company.
Exactly.
So those guys are the ultimate risk bearers, right? The reinsurers?
Well, so the primary insurer retains a lot of the risk, and then they give some to the reinsurance company. Not all of it. And it's interesting what's happening in Florida now anyway is reinsurance companies don't want to be there. There's rampant fraud in the state aside from the risk of these hurricanes.
In Florida?
No. Yes. Very much so. So they've been stepping back to begin with. So before any of this is even happening, primary companies are having a lot of trouble getting reinsurance to the point where some of them are leaving the state or actually going insolvent.
Interesting. So who are the biggest reinsurers? Are we talking about Munich Re or international
companies? Yeah, so the biggest reinsurers in the world are this Munich Re, Swiss Re. I don't cover them. The companies I cover are based out of Bermuda. Their names like Renaissance Re, Everest Re. They will definitely have some exposure, probably less than the bigger companies, though.
So how about some of the primary insurers that might have some risk? I mean, I just think of all those gleaming office towers that all the Wall Street firms are taking up now in the law firms. I mean, it is a major skyline. It is a major city. Man, some of these insurance companies might really be, I'm sure they're paying attention to it like you are.
Of course they are. Of course they are. So the biggest primary insurer is State Farm, which is not a public company.
Okay.
Then there's also a lot of the homes in the state are with the state fund. It's the taxpayers essentially paying for it themselves. There's other names like Allstate, Chubb would be a name, AIG, who would have exposure to maybe commercial properties, not outsized though.
So does FEMA have any bearing on this? I mean, do they go in there and help out to some extent, or?
I think I guess so. It will, you know, eventually, depending on how bad it is, it wouldn't matter dramatically for the insurance companies what FEMA does, but I guess it all depends on the severity of the storm.
What's the big story long-term thought about the insurance business? Climate change, just more and more radical, you know,
there's
kind
bound
of events,
to be a big take on
more
it,
fires, bigger fires, more floods, bigger floods, hurricanes, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's all happening. I mean, the reinsurers are kind of the first line in this. So they're the ones that are stepping back and saying these risks are getting too big to take. What probably will happen, we just had a call today with someone who said there might be more public-private partnerships, meaning the insurance companies are just going to say, we're just not doing it. And if you want to live close to a wildfire area or you want to live in a hurricane-prone area, then the state is going to have to work out some solution with you. And it's going to ultimately fall on taxpayers.
But you do see these kind of events happening more frequently.
We do. I mean, there's no one is saying that climate change is not happening. I would say one thing. There was a big period of kind of benign weather right before this, and now we're seeing more extremes. So could we be in a mean reversion, or could we be in a kind of crazier weather forever?
Right.
You know, we don't know.
All right, good stuff. Matthew Palazzola, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Analyst covering the property insurance business, joining us in studio. He does not phone it in. He comes in studio. So we're talking about Hurricane Ian. Obviously, it's a big, big, big issue for all the good folks down there in Florida to deal with. Looks like it'll be a pretty significant storm. But there's also the business end of it, the P&L end of it, which is the insurance angle and kind of what is the insurable losses potential in some of these markets. So guys like Matthew, help us out there.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Matt Miller. I'm on Twitter at MattMiller1973.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. I'm on Twitter at PT Sweeney. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide at Bloomberg Radio.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.